You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Welcome. I am Michaela Novak, Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. It is my great pleasure and privilege to speak to Giandomenica Bescio. Giandomenica Bescio is Professor of History of Economic Thought, Methodology of Economics, and the Theory of Entrepreneurship in the Department of Economic and Social Sciences, Statistics and Mathematics, ESOMAS, at the University of Torino, Italy. She is currently the National Secretary of ISPE, which is the Italian Association for the History of Economic Thought, and a member of the Institute for Political Studies International Advisory Board and the Estoril Political Forum's Board of Conveners. She has been a visiting scholar or professor at Duke University, Yeshiva University in New York City, VSE University in Prague, the New School for Social Research, and UTS in Sydney. Giandomenica Bescio's research specializations include the history of political economy, Austrian economics, feminist economics, and women economists' contributions to economic thought. Her major publications include several articles published in journals such as The History of Political Economy and Journal of Economic Methodology, and multiple books, including on the philosophical origin of neoliberalism in the history of economic thought, the history of feminist and gender economics, and the economics and philosophy of the several spheres doctrine as it pertains to the household division of labor. Bescio received her PhD in the history of economic thought from the University of Florence. And finally, I'll also mention that Professor Bescio is a very important thinker on the subjects of gender and feminist economics, as well as the history of economic thought, with the distinctiveness of her intellectual contributions resting in her ability to connect these subjects to the broader mainline political economy and classical liberal philosophical traditions. Her latest book, entitled The Doctrine of the Separate Spheres in Political Economy and Economics, Gender Equality and Classical Liberalism, is available through the Palgrave Studies in Classical Liberalism series. Giandomenica, it is a great pleasure to have you speak with us today. Welcome to the Hayek Program Podcast.
Thank you so much, very much for hosting me. It is my pleasure to share my thoughts with you, and it's my pleasure to be part of this podcast. So I'm looking forward to share my thoughts with you.
Absolutely. The sentiment is shared. So I think the way we'd like to usually start out with this conversation is to get a bit of a sense of your intellectual background. What brings us to your intellectual system of thinking as it is today? So as noted in my introductory preamble, you were certainly noted for your expertise in gender and feminist economics. Your intellectual positionality, if I can put it that way, as a leading scholar seeking to intersect these specializations in economics with classical liberal thought is certainly occupying a distinctive niche. So my first question, Giandomenica, is what factors or influences inspired you to study gender and feminist economics? Were there any influential scholars upon your scholarly life, your formative scholarly life, or even certain social or political events in the world that inspired your own interests in these fields of gender and feminist economics? What got you interested in these subjects?
Thank you so much for this question. Well, I started to study gender and feminist economics being inspired by my own story as a woman, as an academic scholar. As a classical liberal thinker, I wanted to analyze the history of the road to freedom. As an economist and an historian of economic thought, I tried to consider that history within my discipline and outside in the real world, in the market, in the social institution. Finally, as a woman, I experienced gender inequality, even in my privileged position. I experienced gender biases. I've experienced that sometimes young generations tend to take for granted women's rights without having a clue of what made gender equality possible, at least formally, and above all, without knowing that gender inequality still persists everywhere and in any sectors with many differences. So it's my own story, my personal story and my intellectual story as a scholar.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, that is actually extremely interesting. I mean, so your own intellectual story is a pointed case of a combination of your practical experience in the world, as you've mentioned, combined with scholarly interest, which I think would seem to me to provide opportunities for very productive sort of contributions to the field. I mean, you have a personal passion combined with an intellectual interest. And I think putting those two together combines productively. So yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for outlining that.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. That's what usually scholars do. I mean, they try to combine their own personal experience with their intellectual interests. So.
Precisely. So one of the key activities of the Liberty Fund is the organization of hosting of what is called the Liberty Matters online discussion forum, whereby specialists in certain fields come together to discuss key topics. I'm well aware that you've been involved yourself with the Liberty Fund for many years, but I'm wanting to sort of point to a particular episode of your involvement in February 2023, so fairly recent. So here you were the leading participant for a discussion for the Liberty Matters opportunity, and for reasons of disclosure, I'll also mention my own involvement in this along with Jamie Lemke and Arnold Kling, in which you argued there that we as classical liberals and thinkers in general need feminist economics. Why is that? Why do we need feminist economics, Gian Domenica?
Well, I think that, you know, classical liberals usually agree on the fact that human beings are all equal regardless of their gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, income, and whatever. They tend to consider freedom more important than equality. However, classical liberals must admit that when a choice is the inevitable result of a constraint that is imposed and not chosen, freedom cannot but decline, and sometimes, depending on the nature of the imposition, it can collapse. Standard economics, based on the mechanism of maximization of a utility function, does not really clearly clarify the motivation of the persistence of the gender inequality, neither in the market — there are gender labor gap, gender wage gap, and phenomena such as glass ceiling, which is the difficulty to get promotions for women — nor within the household, where the division of unpaid care labor is still a second shift, mainly for women. Rather, standard economics justifies somehow the status quo. Feminist economics goes beyond. the status quo and tries to explain the motivation behind agents' revealed preferences by introducing notions such as social pressure, gender stereotypes, discrimination, and self-constraint. So the act of maximization may be rational, but not free per se. It implies freedom if and only if preferences are the result of a condition of liberty and freedom. For this reason, classical liberals, I think, cannot ignore feminist economics, and they actually need to find some way to converge or at least to talk with feminist economics. In spite of the fact that recently, in the last decades, the label feminism has been much more related with the, you know, let's say socialist or super progressive tradition. But from the historical point of view, the history of the ideas, the notion of gender equality does belong to the tradition of classical liberals. So why don't have a connection? That's my point, my entire point.
Yeah. So your response is really fascinating, in fact, because it sort of prompts me to think of sort of two things. So the more immediate thought I had was that in 1995, Steve Horwitz wrote a wonderful paper looking at the ways in which Austrian economics and feminist economics share some intellectual complementarities. And one of the important ways which you've alluded to with your reference to utility functions was the way in which both Austrian economics and feminist economics both eschew reductive interpretations of the utility function as ordering human preferences. So from that, on that basis, if we have a sort of a richer sort of set of preferences, then we have the opportunity to actually bring in some of those more socio-cultural dimensions that may feed into our preferences, and gender has to be one. And so just on this, following from that, then I'm actually really fascinated by your interconnection that you make between freedom and equality. Now, if we think about equality, we're not necessarily thinking about equality of outcome, which, of course, you know, many classical liberal economists and mainline political economists like Hayek and so on would decry. But we're thinking here of an equality of opportunity, or perhaps even more appropriately or appositely, an equality of interest. So it seems to me that if there are inequalities of treatment in a society with gender acting as the relevant variable which is driving that inequality, then that actually may have some risks with respect to the capacity of women in particular, but also men. In fact, we all have a gender, right, in terms of being able to exercise their agency. So I thought your comments here are really important in terms of linking freedom and equality, both properly understood.
Yes, I'm glad that you mentioned, first of all, Steve Horwitz and his article. It was basically an article where he tried to, you know, understand the possible similarities between Austrians and feminists. And I got very inspired by reading that paper at the very beginning of my interest for feminist economics and, let's say, gender issues within economic theory. Yeah, the second point is that, of course, freedom and equality should be somehow, analyze in a much complex way rather than as a trade-off. There's no trade-off between them. And this is very important, especially for minorities in general. And you're right, you mentioned men as well. There are some places where men can be discriminated for several reasons. And we are talking about gender, but of course the status of minority is also very complex. You can have double minority, a status of double minorities, for example. You are a woman and you are a woman of color, for example. And, for example, you have a non-mainstream, let's say, so a non-majority status of about your sexual identity and so forth. So minority is a very complex concept, and it's very important that as classical liberals, we try to analyze how, which is the best way to guarantee both freedom and equality of opportunities for everyone, regardless of their status of minority, which is a fact.
Yeah, indeed. And so I think that's very useful what you say, Gian Domenico, because so the refrain of intersectionality is can just be interpreted as having analytical properties that try to attend just to the concrete complexities that we experience in the world. And just a sort of a final reaction, if I may. So thinking about the complementarities of freedom and equality, of course, we may well recall Adam Smith's interconnection between liberty, equality, and justice. So he saw these concepts as complementing, and we can argue so should we. So if we can probably now turn to the subject of your latest book, which is The Separate Spheres Doctrine. So I'd like to turn to that now. So throughout his major works, Friedrich Hayek identified the existence of spheres of human action and interaction, which are centered contrastively around political action and the exercise of coercive public powers by the agencies of government versus the private or non-state sphere in which individuals are presumably free to pursue their own projects and act in accordance with their idiosyncratic needs, wants, and priorities. So your book refers to a sphere theory that is classified actually on a gender basis, a sphere for men's activities and a sphere for women's activities. So I'm interested in asking you, Gian Domenico, what is the nature of the separate spheres doctrine as you describe in your book? Are you able to sort of flesh that out for us, please?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for this question. Well, simply put, the doctrine of in my book, the doctrine of the separate sphere is an example of the so-called social construction of gender. It is rooted in the idea that public and private life are strictly separated. The doctrine asserts that certain areas of life belonging to the public sphere, such as the economy and the political arena, are best suited for men, while certain areas of life within the private sphere, the domestic sphere, are considered best suited for women. Indeed, according to the doctrine, if society is to be at its most functional and prosperous, men and women should adhere to the roles that align with their respective genders. Men are required to perform their skills in the public spheres, while women are required to achieve their abilities in the private spheres. As the public sphere was the domain of power and money, men traditionally assumed the roles of leaders and patrons over women, whose subjection was the natural effect of their placement in the private sphere. So in my book, I describe, by adopting the narrative of the history of economic thought, how economists either reinforce or rejected the doctrine by specifically considering two intertwined phenomena. First, the role of women within the domestic sphere by performing their role of wives and mothers, being care providers, by performing unpaid labor. And this is the so-called marriage theory in economics, or the economics of the family. Second, the economic and social consequences of women, and especially married women, entering the public sphere when they got a job and became economically independent, competing with men. So Hayek, in his definition, belonged to the group of scholars who degendered the two spheres by depicting the private sphere as the realm of intimate human relations, protected from the influence of the public sphere. from the state, for example. While feminist scholars have scrutinized the domestic sphere and especially the institution of marriage as the primary source of women's subjection. So many of them, talking about feminist economists and feminist scholars in general, have rejected the idea that the private sphere is a zone exempt from the state interference. Because the institution of marriage and the institution of family are subjected to norms, rules, and legislation. So Hayek belongs to that kind of classical liberal tradition, such as Benjamin Constant's difference between the freedom of ancient versus the freedom of moderns. But again, feminist economics is very, very interested in considering precisely the interference of the public sphere on the domestic sphere.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for that overview of the concept of the separate spheres. I mean, that's incredibly useful. So I thank you for that. What was really interesting in your response and that I picked up on was your reference right at the start to this idea of a social construction. So I think that that might be sort of useful just to sort of tease out briefly while we have time. So this idea of social construction is canonically exposited by Berger and Luckman in a book written in the late 1960s called The Social Construction of Reality. And so I think here again, with this idea of social construction, it's a mainstay in sociology and to a lesser extent psychology, but it is a concept that I think can be very profitably taken up by mainline political economists and classical liberalism, classical liberals, because it is an encompassing enough theory to be able to give us recognition of structure in the world, and that can include institutions that help sort of guide our expectations and behaviors, but also giving us enough room to exercise agency to change those structures, certainly to the extent that multiple numbers of people become socially aware, let's say, of the inadequacies of institutions, or that may include institutions being overly constraining of the things that people would like to do in their lives in terms of self-realization and self-actualization. And you can see here how gender is a really nice and interesting application of sort of social construction. I mean, obviously, gender is a sort of concept that sort of provides a certain and very important sort of form of sort of structure, right, in terms of our sort of cognitive understandings and our sort of practical everyday experiences. But the social construction theory, I think, provides enough scope for agency as well, by which people can express gender differently, and that has to sort of be quite evident in terms of how, for example, women have broken out, let's say, of this sort of private domain, the sphere of the home, into the market, into the economy, for very great benefit for society as a whole.
Absolutely, yes, definitely. This is social construction of gender helps economic theory as well, not just the classical liberal tradition, but economic theory to be more complex and to take some, you know, deeper insights into the reality, what really the world is for human beings. So
exactly. And just sort of just thinking about that just a little bit briefly as well. So if you think about the sort of the history of social thought, social construction theory would necessarily represent an advance on some predecessor ideas, especially functionalist theory, which many have argued sort of provides a sort of overbearing or overweening sort of role for institutions. And the implication there under functionalist ideas is that institutions can't really change, or perhaps even ought not to change, really, if they're to provide sort of semblances of order, whereas the social construction theory that serves as, I interpret it as a bit of a platform for your work, does allow for a certain sense of dynamism, right, in terms of our gendered institutions and our others as well.
Yes, the key word is dynamism, of course, because social institutions are never, I mean, they can stay like that for ages, for millennia. Think about the institution of marriage, for example, and then they can change because, you know, it's a combination of cultural, social, political, even exogenous factors, let's say so. So it's very interesting to combine all these kind of, you know, elements together in order to try to explain a phenomenon.
Yeah, so let's just think about that idea of change to the spheres a little bit more. So the question I have is, how has the emergence of the modern market economy challenged the integrity of gendered spheres? So gendered spheres perhaps is originally understood to be one in which men specialize, as you've mentioned, Gian Domenica, in out-of-home production and income-earning activities, whereas women stay at home to maintain the so-called quote-unquote good order of home and hearth. So how have factors such as productivity growth, perhaps fueled by technological advances, how have these things shaped or reshaped our very conceptions of the separate spheres over time? Have these economic changes intertwined with sociocultural changes to then deliver adjustments to our idea of private and public spheres? And if so, how?
Yes, well, we can say that until modernity, and especially prior to the widespread of the Second Industrial Revolution, the domestic sphere included manifold aspects which were under the double umbrella of a household and family. The concept of a household implied several dimensions, including economic production, consumption, and material culture, in addition to family ties. The concept of the family was equally complex. From a large set of people involved, including relatives, friends, servants, to a narrower definition that excluded individuals not connected through specific contracts, such as marriage, or blood ties. Yet, starting from the 19th century, gender roles began to shape the narrative of the two separate spheres. Men, husbands, were often portrayed as breadwinners and producers, while women, wives, were depicted as homemakers, consumers, and caregivers. The notion of family as a primary social unit became widely accepted by social science scholars, while the concept of individuality lost its appeal. There are several interpretations of this phenomenon, which are basically affected by ideological stances. Let's say that detractors of capitalism and free market suggest that the Industrial Revolution broke the harmony of the household by confining women to the domestic roles, whereas prior to the 18th century, both men and women shared the responsibility for production, which was entirely domestic before the revolution. Conversely, supporters of capitalism and the free market maintained that the subjection of women was a phenomenon present in various historical periods, not just a phenomenon of the capitalistic society. Instead, they contend that the capitalistic system and free market opportunities allowed women to escape the private sphere, promoting their independence and involvement in the public arena. What historical data reveal is that technological changes improved the domestic sphere too, not just the public sphere, and these allowed women to have more time to spend in the public sphere. Although many more factors influenced women entering the public sphere. First and foremost, their access to higher education, which started in early 20th century. So we have two different opposite, let's say, explanation and consideration about the link between technological improvement related with the market and the market economy and the separation of the spheres in the traditional way. And it's basically based, as I mentioned before, on ideological political framework, which every researcher has, of course.
So that's really fascinating, Gian Domenica, because what you've really done here in a very conspicuous and explicit way, of course, is that you've indicated that material developments actually intertwine with ideational, if not ideological, trends. And you'd be very well aware, of course, of the contributions of Deirdre McCloskey and many other economic historians, for example, that have really tried to sort of wrestle with the nature of this relationship between the material world and the ideational world. Obviously, you know, some scholars will sort of posit an idea of separability between even, you know, if we can call those spheres, right, between the material and the ideological. But what you're really sort of pointing to is an intertwinement or an entanglement really between the two, because I guess individuals as gendered individuals are not only subsisting and hopefully flourishing in the world thanks to material advances, but very importantly, and this is probably one of the key functions of entrepreneurship, for example, is the ability to intertwine sort of material usages with ideas to be able to create better environments, better home environments, better public spaces progressively, if perhaps unintentionally on the part of any single individual, to produce betterment for more people. So it would seem to me that the sort of the topic of the subject of maternity actually really reveals the intertwinement of materialities in the different spheres of our lives, combined with ideas which have, you know, come together quite organically to produce better forms of social coordination and development.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned Deirdre McCloskey's work. That's precisely my point. I mean, the material progress is something that has helped humanity to prosper. And for humanity, I mean everyone. This is a very important point to underline when we talk about the connection between material wealth, let's say so, and the development of ideas. So we can't make the same mistake of separating material versus, ideals or idea, simply put.
And it would seem that from the vantage point of academic self-interest, you'd want to have academic environments in which researchers are grappling with quite complexified concepts and narratives of human society to actually make, if anything, from purely self-interest, to make academic life and research work more interesting anyhow. So I got another question about this idea of the spheres and the nature of the evolution of the sphere. So a casual survey of contemporary trends identifies several ways in which the gendered separate spheres doctrine might be commanding some degree of recognition, if not esteem, among certain members of the public in today's world. So, for example, during the coronavirus pandemic, there were anecdotal reports of households reinforcing certain gender roles, whereby, for example, women spent relatively greater amounts of time toward the care and education of children, as well as maintaining home life. There are some other interesting examples in the contemporary world, perhaps even in the sort of domain of social movements. For example, the so-called trad wives or traditional wives movement, emphasizing, as I indicate, traditional gender roles. So consistent with these examples, there are also reinvigorated discussions about how to raise fertility rates throughout the Western world. And that's a huge issue that is really coming to the fore in over recent years. So I'm actually wondering, I've nominated a few different examples, but are these examples rather isolated or fringe issues in your opinion, or do they suggest that the separate spheres doctrine retains some relevancy today, even in the face of the immense economic and sociocultural changes, as we've just previously discussed? What do you think about this?
Well, I think that the doctrine of the separate spheres never dies. And what you mentioned are not isolated examples. They are part of the so-called maternalistic approach, according to which the primary task of a woman is to be a mother. And this maternalistic approach still persists in gender stereotypes, as well as in some political agenda of some governments today in charge. You rightly mentioned those aim to promote, mainly in a propagandistic way, fertility. And some of them are also blaming women who are not following this maternalistic approach. And the maternalistic approach is just the other side of the same coin of paternalism. So this idea that, you know, men can, you know, somehow be the guardian of the weaker sex. So this is the old maternalistic approach. And it's very, you know, fashionable for some groups, including some women. Regarding what happened during the pandemic, I'm glad that you mentioned that. That data clearly reveal that women's double burden became higher during the pandemic. And this leads me to a point that is poignant for me. There is no gender equality in the public sphere without gender equality within the domestic sphere. This is the only way to transform the double burden or the second shift into an amount of responsibilities equally shared by partners, regardless of their gender. So this is what really is important. Not just promoting women in the public sphere, but also promoting the role of men in the domestic sphere. It's a matter of responsibility, which is another key word when we talk about freedom and equality. The notion of responsibility has been fundamental part within the classical liberal tradition.
No, thank you, Gian Domenico. I mean, these are very thought-provoking responses on your part. So it makes me wonder, you talk about the importance of gender equality in the sort of the private sort of sphere of home. And it reminds me of some literature developed here at Mercatus and at George Mason University by Virgil Storr and others about, for example, markets as moral training grounds. And it seems to me that there may be some association with that sort of broad idea of a training ground to the quest to attain greater gender equality. So in this sense, practices, everyday practices, intimate practices of gender equality as emergently developing within home environments, within intimate spaces, provide effectively a training ground for broader the propagation of broader values such as gender respect, such as everyday or common experiences of, you know, of collaboration among people along different genders to become fructifiable. So I find this notion that you've put forward quite not only sort of provocative but extremely interesting and probably very worthy of additional research endeavor.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I completely agree, definitely. Again, we tend to be focused on the public sphere and women entering the public sphere, women on performing their career, you know, becoming leaders and so forth. But we should also consider the domestic sphere and the role of men within the domestic sphere.
Absolutely, we should. So let's now turn our minds to some other work in this space that you've contributed to in recent years. So your excellent book, I must say, A History of Feminist and Gender Economics. In that book, an account is provided of the intellectual emergence of gender and feminist economics as disciplines. So to try to sort of summarize your book in a congestible sort of way, what are the origins of what is known today as gender and feminist economics? So my reading of your book's argument is that scholars who studied these matters possessed an intertwined interest in the economic status of women with moral, if not political, concerns. Who were some of the key figures in the origins of gender and feminist economics? Are there any identifiable classical liberals in this group? What do you think?
Oh, thank you. Well, in my previous book that you just mentioned, I distinguished between gender economics and feminist economics. First of all, dealing with gender issues within economics means to analyze gender inequality in the economy and within economic theory, or how economics explains the origin, the nature, and the effects of gender inequality, and eventually provides a way to reduce it. So there are two ways to cope with it. First, the adoption of standard mainstream neoclassical, whatever, economics, which officially emerged in the 1970s with Gary Becker's research program. Second, feminist economics, which emerged in the same period as a challenge or a rejection to Becker's approach. This is the main reason why feminist economics is regarded as an heterodox approach to economics. Becker and his followers started their research by analyzing the traditional division of labor between partners within the family. They consider it as a result of several factors: the biological and psychological differences between men and women, as well as different investments in human capital between boys and girls. They especially insisted on the natural propensity of men to fulfill their expected utility function in the market, in the public sphere, vis-a-vis the natural propensity of women to fulfill their expected utility function in the household. Feminist economists of the time, mainly women, rejected the new bargain marriage model a la Becker by considering it not just mainstream, but also male-stream, which means that it was grounded on methodological assumptions that are in favor of men. Specific challenges provided by feminist economics to standard neoclassical economics were several. Let me just tell some of them. The developments of models able to explain endogenous preferences. Why do I choose to be a housewife for all my life, for example? It's my freedom of choice, or it's something that has been forced by, I don't know, my family, my peer, my culture, whatsoever. Second, the rejection of rational choice theory as the only way to explain a choice, a decision-making process. The insistence on the role of gender stereotypes in favor of men as a determinant of the traditional division of labor. The analysis of the origin of institutions that privilege men and disadvantage women. Finally, but not finally, actually, the development of a better economic model of caring. Those are a few of the main, you know, challenge of feminist economists of the time, again, mainstream neoclassical economics a la Becker, which was very important at the time. So, well, Becker got the Nobel Prize in 1992 for extending the economic behavior also to family and marriage theory. So classical liberals within this group, well, as I said, and I'm always trying to underline whenever I can, the request for gender equality does belong to the history of classical liberal tradition. And it is grounded on what has been labeled the woman question, which emerged during the 19th century. With the work of Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Astell, Harriet Martineau, Olympe de Gouges, Jane Marcet, Harriet Taylor Mill, John Stuart Mill, to name but a few. Classical liberals within feminist economics? A few, and we are growing, I guess.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. And this was a very neat encapsulation of the history of gender and feminist economics. So, you know, Becker versus a heterodox strand. But also, I was really thankful that you're able to tie back to a broader tradition in classical liberalism. That I'm so glad that you actually raised among other figures the figure of Harriet Martineau, very underappreciated, but had contributed major developments in the early field of sociology. So, thank you. Earlier in our discussion, you'll recall I mentioned the figure of Steve Horwitz. So this will lead me to my next question, which is, so feminist economics and the branches of what is today labelled as mainline political economy are grouped under this expansive classifier of heterodox economics that you mentioned. So this shared positionality of feminist and mainline economics, I argue, would imply the potential for commonalities between these two strands of thinking. So we've briefly mentioned Horwitz, but I'm interested in your views as to what are some of the key methodological and analytical positions embraced by feminist economics that might be considered as being similar to or complementing mainline economics, for example, Austrian economics. But then the question goes, well, how far do the similarities go? Are there then, you know, key differences between feminist economics and, let's say, mainline political economy? Let's say, for example, on the subject of cooperation versus competition as values. So, what do you think of the similarities and differences?
Well, that differences and similarities depend on which mainline political economy approach we are talking about and which feminist economics also we are considering. But let's get focused on feminist economics and Austrian economics with a special memory of Steve, because you specifically mentioned it and it was so important in my intellectual history. So there are many common points between Austrian economics and feminist economics. Let me enlist some of them. They commonly share the idea that competition and cooperation, as you just mentioned, may be the two faces of the same coin. Both Austrian and feminist agree on considering the fascination of the opposition between competition and cooperation as useless, sexist, and basically wrong. They also agree in regarding the role of emotions in human decision process as decisive, as well as the fact that emotions do not bring any rational motivation within the decision process, which is much more complex than an act of maximization based on efficiency. Again, both Austrian economics and feminist economics are against the expert center model or top-down learning process and promote a dynamic process of learning. This is a key point in both approaches. Finally, but there are more, the innovative attitude of entrepreneurs emphasized by Austrians as the core of economic development is similar to feminist economics' idea that women's attitude in problem solving is able to create a better social capital. There are, of course, differences too, especially if we consider the contribution of feminist economists who are, for example, Marxist, who have a very progressive economic policy agenda, but those are legitimate ideological differences which impact, of course, on the analysis. But I do believe that what I've just mentioned are really helpful in trying to find a convergence between Austrians and feminists within economic theory. And of course, there are many more similarities and differences between other heterodox approaches and feminist economics, for example, post-Keynesians, sense capability approach, and so forth. But as you mentioned, and we are here, I really like to stress out the possible convergence between Austrians and feminists.
No, that's excellent. And thank you for mentioning the point about the contribution of women to social capital, because it jogs my mind to recall, hopefully for the benefit of our listeners who may be interested in reading, there was a paper that was produced not long ago, maybe about 3-odd years ago, by Pills and Schoenegger in the journal called Episteme. And the paper title goes along the lines of something like, on the similarities between market liberalism and standpoint epistemology, where the authors are saying that there is some interesting connection between Hayek's interpretation of knowledge and the feminist economics, or even broader sort of feminist theoretical account of women's access to idiosyncratic and unique knowledge, and the important properties that these forms of knowledge have in the world. So, no, thank you. Thank you very much, Gian Domenica. That is terrific. So, if I may, we might just get on to the final question. We're almost on the hour. So, I have noted in various dispatches that you've referenced the figure of Barbara Bergman. So Barbara Bergman, she is one feminist economist, as I've just said, who features in your work. And she was an American economist whose parents and grandparents fled the anti-Semitism of Europe in the early 1900s. And Bergman passed away in 2015. So I've been long been fascinated by Bergman's work myself, especially her position that one way to ameliorate gender conflicts regarding the distribution of household labor would be to commodify household production, or in other words, outsource certain aspects of household production to the marketplace. So, for example, you know, just as a sort of a weird sort of little example, if a haircut at a commercial hair salon could replace the old pudding bowl hair cutting techniques performed at home, you know, people might think of the image of the movie Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey as the figure Lloyd Christmas with the pudding bowl haircut. So if a hair salon can replace hair cutting at home, then other possibilities surely abound, such as reallocating childcare activities to for-profit or not-for-profit providers outside of the sphere of the home environment. So what do you see as being some of the core contributions of Barbara Bergman? And are there any ways in which she provides insights of potential value to students of mainline political economy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you summarized very well Barbara Bergman's main idea. I can add that she was my hero. I was really inspired by her life, her intellectual biography, her commitment to feminism and to economics. So she initially examined race and gender-based occupational segregation by scrutinizing gender inequality in the labor market. And doing so, she investigated the resource distribution within families and the division of labor within the household. She definitely rejected Becker's approach and clearly stated that the only possible, quoting, ticket to gender equality was a totally androgynous model based on commodification. So what you just mentioned. Only this model may eliminate gender stereotypes and barriers, making it possible for women to inhabit the same world as men currently do. She explained that this transition towards gender equality will be completed through the integration of the male and female worlds, so the two spheres. She regarded gender discrimination in the labor force and in the family as two sides of the same coin. Namely, her expression was sex role case system. And this system has penalized not only women, but the society as a whole. Again, this is a very classical liberal approach. And basically, she was one of, I guess, the only founder of feminist economics who was totally classical liberal. Although she proposed a progressive agenda, but still she refused to consider any approach related with Marxism or socialism as useful for the path towards gender equality. So she proposed a dual strategy as the only possible path to gender equality. Ensuring equal opportunities in the job market for both sexes and fostering an equitable distribution of responsibilities between spouses in managing household affairs, raising children, regardless of their gender. She was very modern. And I totally got inspired by her vision, and I do believe her work as a whole may be a powerful instrument for students today, for students who are interested in this kind of approach. But not just for students, for everyone. She also wrote a lot of non-academic writings, absolutely accessible to everyone. So thank you for asking me about her.
Oh, for sure. And I was going to say in passing that Horwitz and Bergman as role models is a very powerful foundation for modern social scientific inquiry. So that's fantastic. So look, I sincerely thank you, Gian Domenico Bescio, for your time and crucial insights into the gendered nature of economic behavior and the influence of the separate spheres doctrine in intellectual history. Again, Gian Domenico's latest book, The Doctrine of the Separate Spheres in Political Economy and Economics, Gender Equality and Classical Liberalism, is available through the Palgrave Studies in Classical Liberalism series. Gian Domenico, thank you once again.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure. And I hope this helps students and people interested in this, in gender equality and classical liberal tradition. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.